Welcome to Tube Talk, the show dedicated to helping you become a better video creator so you can get more views, subscribers, and build your audience. Brought to you by vidIQ. Download for free at vidIQ.com.
Oh, yeah, baby. Welcome back to the Tube Talk podcast presented by vidIQ. I am your host, Viper, the man about tech, executive producer here at the IQ. And let me tell you all something. I'm about to blow your mind this week because I have a question, y'all. I have a simple question for my up-and-coming creators out there. And my question for you is, what if I told you that your title and thumbnail is more important than the actual video you make? What did you say, Viper? What did you say? I said, what if I told you that your title and thumbnail, that combo, is actually more important than the video that you make? You're going to hear that and a lot more from this week's guest, famed YouTube strategist Matt Gielen, here in a few minutes on the podcast. But he dropped a whole bunch of fire this week, and that nugget was part of the fire that he dropped. But it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, right? Because we as creators, we spend so much time trying to make the best video possible, but you have to get people to actually click on the video to watch it. And they're not going to do that if your title and your thumbnail aren't up to the par. Okay? First impressions are everything. And we know that the first impression that you make as a creator on a potential viewer, title, thumbnail. So it stands to reason that, of course, they will be more important than the actual content because you got to dress the content up properly if you want people to click on it. You got to have that window dressing. You know what I'm talking about. When you're walking around downtown in these urban metro areas at Christmas time and you are doing these window shopping, you see all the window dressing out there and they kind of make you want to go inside the store because the windows look so enticing. Yes, the same could be said of your title and thumbnail. Your thumbnail needs to be looking enticing. It needs to have that aura of intrigue that makes people want to click on it. Because then, once people click into the video and start watching the video, then the quality of your content matters. But if they don't actually make it to the content, does all your hard work even matter? If they don't actually make it to the point where they are watching your video? Something that I started doing personally with my own content this year, and before I ever hit record on a video, I make my title and my thumbnail first. No matter how long it takes, I make my title and my thumbnail first. Or at the very least, I have the idea for a title or thumbnail first. And then, and only then, will I go out and record a video. Because there's just something special about having the title and thumbnail made before you record the video. It sets the tone for the video. It provides some good juju. It's hard to explain unless you actually do it yourself. So I'm encouraging all my fellow creators out there, if you've never tried it, try making your title and thumbnail first before you record the video, and then let me know how you feel. If you try this, tweet at me at vidIQ. Make sure you use the hashtag TubeTalk and let me know how it felt to make your title and thumbnail first, then record the video. Because from personal experience, it feels very good to have that stuff out of the way before I ever hit the record button. It literally makes recording the video easier. It just makes me feel better. And again, like I said earlier, it sets the tone for my recording of that video when I have my title and thumbnail done first. That is what we are talking about here and more this week as we talk about the YouTube algorithm or algorithms, because there are multiple, but we'll get more into that on the podcast. But there's a lot of misconceptions and there's just a lot of narcissism at creators. Now, creators, of course, have to have a certain level of narcissism. You kind of have to as a creator, but some of us go a little bit too deep with our narcissism and we think about ourselves too much and we don't think about the experience of the viewer. When you're watching YouTube, not as a creator, but as a viewer, think about some of the things that make you click on a video, or think about some of the things that make you, or some of the things that you enjoy about the content that you watch on YouTube. Because I promise you, if you take a few minutes to think about, or maybe even write down some of the things that you enjoy as a YouTube viewer, you can take those same things and incorporate them into the way that you do your content on YouTube, and you might get better results. Because again, content creators, we are at the mercy of the viewers on YouTube. What we do for the viewer. We don't do it for ourselves because we're not trying to get ourselves to watch our content. We're trying to get potential viewers out there to watch our content. So you have to make your content viewer friendly. Like me personally, I will not put mid-roll ads in my videos as a creator because I do not like seeing them in the content that I watch as a viewer. Now, I'll put ads at the beginning or the end, but I will not put ads in the middle of my YouTube videos as a creator because I feel like it ruins the viewing experience. When I'm into a video, I don't want to be interrupted by an ad. I just don't. That's just me. I know that's just me. That's a personal thing that I have. you might feel differently. But knowing that information about how I feel as a YouTube viewer, I did apply that as a YouTube creator in the fact that I do not put mid-roll ads in my YouTube video. So that is a perfect example of how you, as a creator, can take some of your viewing habits and your viewing thoughts and logic and apply it to what you do as a creator to make the best possible viewing experience for your audience. Because it's all about your audience and what you do for them. It's not about what they can do for you. It's about what you can do for your audience. And with that said, I think it's time to roll to the podcast and talk to the YouTube strategist, Matt Gielen himself. So let's roll to the podcast. How you doing, Matt?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on, man.
Man, thank you for making the time, sir. I appreciate you. So before we get started, I just want to clear up a little bit of confusion for me. There's Little Monster Media, which is what I know you for, but then there's Electric Monster Media. So it's like the same thing or two different things, or what's going on?
It's two different things. Little Monster is the agency portion of our business. So we're still working with, you know, media companies and YouTube creators to help them scale their audiences either in production, operations, or consulting and strategy. And then Electric Monster is a company that is buying IP and digital video assets and working to scale those audiences up and, generate additional revenue streams for them.
Okay, so Electric Monster Media is the one that works with the different channels and creators and acquires them and help them grow in different things like that, right?
Yeah, that's the owned and operated portion of our business where we actually own the assets, and the Little Monster is the agency portion where we work with third parties.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Okay, so in preparation for this podcast, sir, I watched a 25-minute video you did about 11 months ago where you broke down the YouTube algorithm. And to say that I was fascinated would be a vast understatement.
Thank you.
Your understanding of the YouTube algorithm is some PhD level type stuff, my dude. I mean, good Lord, the way you broke it down and how you just dug into the weeds and talked about all these different things. There is just so much going there. So I'm going to try to break it down as best I can here. And hopefully you can help me out here. In the video, you talked about how YouTube used to rely heavily on watch time as far as how the algorithm worked in distributing your video. But sometime a couple of years ago, you highlighted that they switched over to a more satisfaction based criteria. If the viewer clicks, what they watch, what they like, dislike, if they come back, different things like that. So go into it a little bit with us, your understanding of the satisfaction portion of how YouTube recommends videos.
Sure. So I think, you know, satisfaction is probably a bit of a catch-all term, right? And when you think about the recommendation system as a whole, it's a fantastic term. But how do you determine satisfaction when underneath a video, there's no sliding scale for each individual user being like, I am at a 7 out of 10 in my satisfaction, right? And like, even if it had that, you know, what, 5% of the viewers would do that? And yeah, that'd probably be a great sample and they would use that data, but regardless, it doesn't exist. And so you have to think about it in terms of like, what metrics does YouTube have to determine satisfaction for the individual and then for that video as a whole for potential similar viewers of the person who just watched the video, right? And so we think about satisfaction. There's a number of things that go into that. First and foremost is surveys, right? Where they survey a certain percentage of the viewers of a video and ask them about that video. They ask them about their experience on YouTube as a whole. And that feeds into the recommendation system to determine how satisfied viewers are when they watch a video, right? Because you can sit there and watch a video for a long time, right? 25-minute video, be like, what the hell is this guy talking about? I am dissatisfied. This video features me because something Todd said or has said consistently is like, not all watch time is created equal, right? Which is like, that's a fair assessment. So there's the survey aspect of it where they get direct feedback from viewers and filter that into the system. Well, the vast majority of viewers on YouTube do not engage with the platform, right? And right. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about and dealing with, you know, niche communities where there is a higher level of engagement, where there is more back and forth. But the vast majority of viewership on YouTube is passive, right? It's not engaged. It's not commenting. It's not liking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so a great indication of someone being satisfied with a video is that they watch the video. Time is the only universal currency. And so the idea that someone is willing to invest that time into a creator, into a video, is a great and powerful signal towards them being satisfied with that video. And then do they go on and watch more from that user? The next time they're recommended a video by that user, do they click on it, right? Does this video get them to click that like button or comment? These are all signals to the recommendation system that signify that a user was satisfied by that video. And so what ends up happening is YouTube utilizes that data to program their future experience on YouTube. Are they going to serve more videos from that creator later in that session when they come back the next time, when they're on mobile versus on TV versus on their computer? They take all of that into account, and they also utilize that data to determine whether they should serve that video to similar viewers from a contextual standpoint, what device they're on, what time of day, right? What have they watched before or after? And to serve that video to viewers that have similar watch histories and watch patterns to the person who, based on just unfathomable amounts of data, they believe is going to be similar to someone who was really satisfied by that video.
Right. The other thing I heard you talk about was how the recommendation system worked, and it worked in such a way that it will recommend content depending on what type of device the person is watching the content on. So my question to you is, if as I, creator, understand that over 50% of my audience watch it from a cell phone or mobile device, how can I take advantage of that information? Like, how can I tailor my content in such a way that I can get more of my videos recommended because I know that most of my audience is watching from a cell phone?
So what you're referring to is contextualization. And I think probably about 2 or 3 years ago, they really made a concerted effort to contextualize their recommendations a lot more, right? That's in people's homepage and suggested and even in search, right? A great example they give is if you search for cricket on YouTube, if in your history you've watched a lot of sports clips, they're more likely to serve you sports clips from the game of cricket versus if you watch a lot of nature documentaries, they're more likely to serve you videos based on, like, you know, crickets that hop and make noise kind of thing. And within that contextualization, like, what does that mean for us as programmers of a YouTube channel, as creators? How do we look at it? And so from the standpoint of having like 50% of your audience being mobile and, you know, optimizing around that, it's first and foremost kind of thinking about the mobile experience, right? And everything starts with the click. And if you know that the majority of your viewers are going to come off of a mobile device, looking at your thumbnails in the context of a mobile device, especially in relation to videos your audience might also watch, and seeing it, do your thumbnails stand out, right? Because you can't get satisfaction, you can't get watch time, you can't get engagement, you can't do anything if someone doesn't click on your video in the first place. So I would start there and really analyzing like how thumbnails appear on your mobile device. And then from there, looking at the data in terms of like, are your hypotheses as to what thumbnail is going to work well on a mobile device playing out in your data? Like, do your videos get higher click-through rates, relatively speaking, on mobile that you think are going to do well, right? So part of your question jumps over, I think, a very interesting aspect, which is, should you cater to the majority of your audience in that way? Like, if you know the majority is mobile, should you try to get that to be more TV or desktop? And that answer is not an easy answer in the sense of like, well, mobile viewers might watch for less time, have less average view duration in general. Like, we see that in some of our properties, right? You might get a lower RPM on mobile. So it's like, do you want to prioritize for mobile? Well, I think the last time I saw a data point, it was something like 60 or 70% of the YouTube audience was mobile. But then you have to also think about like, what is the goal of your YouTube channel? Right? If the goal of your YouTube channel is to reach more potential customers for a high-end service, well, in my experience, people are less likely to convert on mobile to like training courses or buying certain packages. So maybe it makes more sense to actually look at people who are watching your content on desktop and really optimize for that because you have such a higher conversion rate on your website. That said, if we're just interested in audience development, then you absolutely want to lean into the biggest portion of your audience because those are the ones who are going to be served your content when it first comes out at the highest percentage and the highest rate, right? And so leaning into that core audience with your core value proposition, and that's, you know, what you choose to program in terms of your video, right? That's how you package your videos. That's the length of your videos. That's who's on screen. That's how you start your videos in terms of like intro versus no intro, going straight into the content, not going into the content, right? Are you looking directly in the camera right away? What is going to optimize for that kind of core audience around your core value proposition to get the most viewership possible on a video when it first goes out? Because as we know, the recommendation system is optimized for satisfaction. And the greater number of people that you satisfy when a video goes out, the more YouTube is going to be able to find additional viewers that could be satisfied by that video, right? That YouTube says, you know, we we don't look for audiences for videos. We look for videos for audiences. And essentially what they mean by that is like they want to entertain users and satisfy them and give them what they're looking for. And so if your video is going to do a good job of that, they will put that in front of more and more people. And the way YouTube figures that out is by who has already watched it. And it can be exponential. So if you put a video out and it satisfies two users, and each one of those users has two people that have similar watch histories, YouTube's going to put that video in front of them. And so if you're able to take that from 2 to 100, that rate of growth is going to go way, way faster. And it's far less likely that YouTube's going to run into a roadblock of like, you know, we just can't, you know, find any more people that might be satisfied based on the people that have been satisfied currently.
Gotcha. So you just touched on something else that you talked about in your video, and I would love for you to go in a little bit deeper and explain it. I think when you were talking about how YouTube finds like a two pair of people that watch your videos, and then a day watch it, they will recommend that video to another few select people. I think you kind of qualified that in your video as collaborative filtering. So can you explain that term and what it means for how videos are put out there?
Yeah, collaborative filtering is basically the concept that if person A really likes something, and person B and person C are very similar to person A based on their past actions, let's serve this video to person B and person C and see if that holds up. Because the recommendation system makes predictions, essentially. It predicts that a viewer is going to be satisfied with a certain video or a set of videos and serves that to them. And if person B and C are super into that video and super satisfied by that video, and person D through, you know, M, right, are very similar to A, B, and C, well, that's going to serve it to them. It's going to keep doing that, essentially, until the data proves otherwise. Because person B and C might be very similar to person A, but persons D through M might be slightly different, right? And then you go M to Z. That watch history, those actions, that context starts to get more and more different as you kind of go down that chain, right? And so what YouTube's doing is essentially going through that chain until it gets to a point where it no longer holds up for that chain of people, right? Kind of like a virus. I loathe using that word in the context of our times, but that's essentially how it goes, right? And so like collaborative filtering is basically the idea that similar users will like similar things.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. Now, in your experience with working with different channels, now, this is probably a more particular question as far as how video should be structured, but in your experience working with all the creators that you've worked with in your tenure, how do you personally feel about intros? Are you for intros? Are you against intros? Because I have a theory. I tell new creators that you probably want to avoid the intro because people that are coming onto YouTube and discovering your content don't know who you are and they don't care and they are not there for your intro. But if you absolutely have to do an intro, you should probably keep it to like 4 seconds or less. So what are your thoughts on intros?
So I'll give you the short answer and then I'll prattle on for a minute. So short answer is avoid it. Try to keep it to like 3 seconds. But you kind of want to let people know where they are. And I think TikTok's a really interesting platform in the sense that there's a lot of content that it doesn't feel like an intro, but it is an intro where it'll be like, this is da 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 da, and they're in, right? Where you just kind of like allow people to understand what they're about to watch, but you don't prattle on about it. And a lot of times it can be just a reinforcement. This is not TikTok, back to YouTube now. A reinforcement of the title where it's like, you've given them a value proposition with a thumbnail and a title. It says, this is what you're about to watch. And by having that very short, yes, you've clicked on the right thing by like basically almost restating the title, maybe just restating the title flat out. It basically says like, that wasn't clickbait. You're in the right place kind of thing.
Right.
Now, I think it depends a lot on where your channel is in its kind of growth trajectory. I think it depends on the type of content you're making, like how long that intro should be or whether it should or should not be there. And I think it also depends on kind of the current size of your audience, right? Like MKBHD can probably be perfectly fine doing an intro. Yeah, he gets new audience all the time, but he's also MKBHD. You know, like people know who he does. Is he really concerned that his audience doesn't, you know, come on in that way, right? And like, I get it. But the thing I wanted to prattle on about, if you're not already like, holy shit, he's already prattled on a lot about it, is the difference between a utility channel and an entertainment channel, right? I think one of the biggest areas where YouTube strategists get into like semantic arguments and like, you know, there are no rules. Oh, no, there are a lot of rules. Oh, you know, it's not this thing, but it's kind of this thing, is that we don't designate a difference between entertainment and utility channels. And it took me a long time to recognize that, to be perfectly honest. And like, I think that's where some of the semantic stuff of like disagreements, you know, including people who have appeared on Tube Talk about some of my research and things I've found, comes in the difference between an entertainment and a utility channel. Because like, there are definitely generalized rules that'll hold true for many different types of channels. And there are a lot of exceptions to the rule, right?
Right.
And everybody wants to be an exception to the rule all the time, like every time. Most people are not. But a big part is the difference between a utility channel and an entertainment channel. Right. So if you're a utility channel, right, which Little Monster's YouTube channel, where you saw the video, definitely was. We can go into that too. I have an interesting perspective on that, I think. But regardless, it was a utility channel. For the content we made, people were coming there to get very specific information, right? And I'll be the first one to tell you that I am a terrible, terrible YouTube creator in so many ways. Like, I was very glad that I did it for the period that I did the videos for. And it was a very interesting experience. And I learned a tremendous amount that I had never, I think, fully appreciated or understood before about what it meant to be a creator. I also learned a tremendous amount about a utility channel, because the vast majority of like my time spent on the platform was on entertainment channels. You know, we would take channels from, you know, 5 million monthly views to, you know, 300 million monthly views, and work with movie clips from 150 to a billion. All entertainment channels. I never really worked on like a utility channel, a channel where the value proposition of a given video and of the channel was, I'm going to trade you your time for the information and expertise that I have, which is what Little Monster was. And so like, I think what I didn't understand or appreciate in terms of like the majority of creators, or a huge portion of creators, I should say, is that a lot of these channels, while perfectly entertaining, their audience is based on like utility.
Right.
So think about like an educational channel, right? There are some educational channels who have managed to become entertainment channels, or like, or at least hybrid, right? Where they combine the informational value, the utility to the user in terms of giving them something that, you know, they're looking for or could be interested in, with also being really entertaining, right? And these are the ones that kind of like take off, because it has that combination of being able to bring people in on the value of the information, but also retain them and get them to come back for things that they might have no interest in whatsoever, or not know that they're interested in, right? Where the right value proposition is both utility and entertainment. With a straight utility channel, you have a much harder time in retaining audience, because the value proposition of a given video is, I'm going to give you this information in exchange for that time. And what ends up happening is like, people aren't always looking for the information that you're putting out. I can use Little Monster again as an example. You know, we did videos on titles and thumbnails and metadata and average view duration, and the value to our audience in each one could have been great, or the value of the video. But the audience wasn't necessarily always interested in, well, how do I make my thumbnails better? Because it was only hitting on specific interest to our audience. A better example is like, you know, we would do a video that was like how makeup and beauty channels could do better, like best practices for makeup and beauty channels. Well, that pretty much excluded like 90% of our audience. There was no value to them, at least from a selling point of thumbnail and title, as to like how it could help them. Now, if you actually watch the video, it could be very, very valuable to a lot of people. But like, me as a creator wasn't, you know, engaging enough. The talent on screen was not talented enough to like get people to come no matter what I was talking about. The style was very basic. Talking head, cutaway, blah, blah, blah. Format, straight explainer video. Right. And so together as a package, the only value proposition was the information in the video, the topic of the video. And so that value proposition only hit about 5% of our audience. And that wasn't enough to get it to show up on anyone who's looking for information for like how to grow a makeup and beauty channel kind of thing.
Right. Okay. So for creators like me who make tech content, obviously we would be classified as a utility video. But I myself, I try to make my content as entertaining as possible, even though it's tech, because I know by its nature, tech is boring AF. I mean, just to be honest, tech is boring. I try to infuse some entertainment into it. But at the end of the day, I am a utility channel, because probably people are coming to my channel for some information that they're looking for. And then when they're done, they might move on. If I'm lucky, they'll stay for me and my personality. But by and large, they're coming for the information, the utility of the channel.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of like crafting or understanding a value proposition, I like to actually equate it to movies and like break down the value proposition of a movie first, because it tends to translate very well into a YouTube channel. Not fully, TV shows work too, but to understand like, oh, okay, you know, it's not just social media, personal profile kind of thing. There's a lot that goes into it. First and foremost, when you're thinking about like, you know, am I going to stream The Witcher on Netflix? Well, you have to have an interest in the topic and genre. Same thing is true on YouTube. If you're going to watch a tech review channel or show, you have to have an interest in tech.
Right.
Next is the characters and actors on screen. If you're going to watch The Witcher, you have to like the characters, or at least enjoy watching the characters. You don't necessarily have to like personally in the actors, right? And that's the same thing as like personality on YouTube. Next, when you're watching the show, if the show is shot in like 4:3 and 480, you're probably not going to be super into it because of the style, which is the same exact thing on YouTube. Now, going back to MKBHD as an example, like revolutionized style in tech review, like so many of those are works of art, right? And so it's like you can watch that whether you care about him, whether you care about the iPhone, because they're beautiful. The next thing is like the format. So like if you're doing tech review or format of show, so vast majority of like fictional TV shows are narrative.
Yep.
Sometimes there's other stuff going on, but like they're mostly narrative. Then you have like a game show. It would be like, you know, a challenge and reaction. If we take America's Got Talent, right? There's some commentary because of the judges, right? You could say it's a listicle because of the nature of a competition show with multiple different people. And there's a lot of different like formats packed into this one package. So if like you're looking at a tech review channel that is a explainer and commentary, that's the most common format out there. There's not a huge amount of differentiation. Right. So it's like, what other elements of formats can you infuse into your show to make it feel fresh and unique? But most importantly, what can you do to give people a reason to watch regardless of topic? Because if you're a utility channel and people are just checking out the topic, you are never going to be able to reach enough people on a consistent basis based just on your topic choice. And they're going to come and they're going to watch that one video and you're never going to see them again because they got what they needed. Right. They got the information from that video that they were interested in. What are the hooks? What keeps them coming back to watch you, to watch your show with each new video you upload, regardless of topic? Now, I hate to go to the biggest channel on YouTube and use it as an example, but like Mr. Beast, his value proposition is every video is going to be a larger than life video on something you've never seen before, right? Now, there's other elements into that, right? Obviously him. There's the money aspect of it all. You know, stylistically, he makes phenomenal videos. Like the editing is perfect for YouTube. Now, they're not doing like great camera effects or anything like that, but like stylistically, from like an edit standpoint, from a talking to the camera perspective, it's perfect for YouTube. And then the last thing on style is the use of motion graphics and overall production value. It's not The Witcher from like a quote unquote production value standpoint, but he spends more on a video than most TV shows spend on an episode.
Massive,
That's production value. And just in comparison to other YouTube content, there's a lot of production value there. Like in the video he just did with MKBHD, right? He was showing his cameras. He's got like 500 cameras at this point that he's utilizing. Like what other YouTube channel has ever even come close? It's huge, right? And so like all of that compiles into a value proposition, which means like you can watch him give away gold bars to waitresses. You can watch him be buried alive for 50 hours. You can watch him do Squid Games. Right. And those are different formats, but each video is still delivering on the value proposition, you know, that we just ran through. Right. And so it's about delivering on an overall value proposition. It's going to give people a reason to watch every video as opposed to just come for the information that they need and you never see them again.
This episode of Tube Talk is brought to you by vidIQ's competitors tool. Checking in on what your competition is doing can be a great way to keep up with trends in your area of expertise. If you have vidIQ installed, you can find this tool on the left-hand sidebar within the YouTube studio, and from there you can begin adding channels as your competitors. I like to select a range of channels, from the ones that I find to be the leading voices in my niche, all the way down to channels that get similar views to my own. The way that this helps me personally is that I can start to actually detect patterns in the types of videos that my competitors are releasing, which helps me discover some fresh ideas that are already proven to be working. The vidIQ extension works in both Chrome and Firefox browsers, and you can download it for free at vidIQ.com.
Now, I want to dig a little bit deeper into what you were talking about just now with the whole Netflix thing, because also in the video that I watched that you made 11 months ago, you made a comment about how your YouTube channel should look like a Netflix show page. Single show. When you go to Netflix show page, let's say you go to the Witcher show page, you got the show page with the Witcher and you got all the different episodes. Now, the episodes don't have to be the same thing, and it's probably better if they're not the same thing. They might have different formats, different structures, different plot lines, different things like that. But when you land on the show page for The Witcher, you know what you're getting. Like, you're going to get Geralt. You're going to get monsters, slaying, fighting, different things like that. And you said that that's how your YouTube channel should look. So I'm curious. Again, I'm going to go back to me because I can only talk about my thing, but I have a tech channel, and right now I have mostly Apple content on there. But next month, I want to make some Samsung content because Samsung has an event happening next month. In your opinion, if somebody were to land on my channel next month and I have Apple content and Samsung content, even though it all falls under the tech umbrella, is that something that is doable in your opinion, or would it be better if I just focused on Apple content per se?
Well, I think it would depend on why your audience is watching your content, right? And right. The answer to that question is your value proposition or your brand. If people are watching your content because they want to see your take on things, then it doesn't matter what you make content about. As long as it's kind of like, you could make content about crypto or desktop computers, right? It's about understanding what that core value proposition is in order to make that assessment. Like, I would have to spend time with your data, spend time with you, spend time with your content and a lot of it to be able to make like a definitive like call on that. But I think maybe the Netflix show page reference was a little too specific on the entertainment front, in the sense of the difference between entertainment and utility, in the sense of the value proposition for The Witcher is essentially the show, right? Everything that goes into it that we kind of discussed. The value proposition for, let's do cooking, right? Who's the guy from Eastern Europe that always has a huge smile and he delivers like huge, huge volumes of foods to like, you know, underserved communities and, you know, shelters and all that sort of stuff. But like, that's a cooking show that has the value proposition of like, yeah, he's going to make these really huge, massive dishes and stuff, but you're also going to get this huge payoff of seeing him just like absolutely delight underserved and underprivileged people right. with this food. You're going to see that generosity. You're going to see that overwhelmingness. And he does it with this huge smile, right? Which just makes you smile while you're watching it. Right? It just makes you feel good. So if we're tapping into that, then it doesn't matter what the topic of your video is, because you're delivering on all these other elements. And so I hate to answer your question with a question, but it would be like, well, what's the value proposition in your channel, right? And I think a lot of utility channels are not completely honest with themselves in terms of like what the value proposition of their channel is, and whether they're just like a straight up utility channel, or if they're able to blend in some elements of style and personality and format to have an audience that comes back for each new upload. And the easiest way to tell is if like you've got an upload that has a million views and, you know, you've got a couple with a couple hundred thousand views, but the vast majority of your content does, we'll call it 5,000 views, but you have 100,000 subscribers, right? And I'm using subscribers not because it matters, but because it's a benchmark. And so like, if that's the case, well, then you've got a good audience, right? I'm not 5,000 views of video is great, right? Like, let's not poo-poo that. But you're still in a place where it's like, it's very clearly that you have a core audience, which is great, that wants to see you and your show. But you're not kind of like retaining everything that's coming in because people are there for a specific utility in that way. And so think about like, well, how do we get there? How do we add that? How do we like infuse that? You have to look at those kind of core elements of format and of style. Just wrapping it up in terms of like Netflix, it's about that single core value proposition and not having many different ones. Love them to death, but Mystery Guitar Man, real old reference here. Mystery Guitar Man would do these like 3-minute motion graphic music type videos that were awesome. Just awesome. And then he did like a telenovela, like out of nowhere on his channel, right? And like, good for him. He's now a big movie director. He's super, super talented. The telenovela was cool, but it didn't serve on the core value proposition of his channel and of his audience, which was, we want to see 3-minute music videos with crazy motion graphics. Right. And so they didn't watch it, which means that YouTube served the telenovela to a whole bunch of people who were like, no, I'm good. I don't, this is not for me. and noticed that they did not click on it. And they did not click on any of those like 8 or 10 episodes or however many it was. And so YouTube looks at that and goes, well, you're no longer interested in this user or this uploader, this creator. So we're not going to serve you future uploads. And so like, I don't know if this is exactly the case, but essentially, you know, going from, you know, 3 to 5 million views a video prior, he could have been looking at 1 million, maybe 500,000 views after. And I'm probably butchering the timeline here, but it illustrates the point of having a single core value proposition. And that's what I mean by a Netflix show page. Everything has to deliver on that core value proposition. And if you've got a whole bunch of like different value propositions, you're going to have a fractured audience who's not going to watch your content, is not going to be served your content in the future, because YouTube can really only analyze a viewer's interaction on all of your content, not on specific shows or series or this thing or that thing. It just sees channel produces widgets. You are no longer interested in those widgets.
So basically what it comes down to is the creator knowing what your audience wants from you and then delivering on what they want. And like you said, maintaining that value proposition that you have to find. Gotcha. Okay.
Exactly.
So something else I want to talk about, hopefully you can enlighten me. As I was watching the video yesterday, you talked about something called the DPP optimizer. Now, I don't really get this much, but the example that you kind of gave, or the one that I remember in my head, is that let's say I upload a video yesterday and I upload another video today. Well, the video today is going to knock the video from yesterday off of the homepage, and it's going to cause it to get less viewed because it's going to be less visible because you uploaded a new video on top of the other video. So can you go a little bit more deeper into the DPP optimizer and what it means for content exactly?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the paper I'm citing there is one that was written by Google. They hedged a little bit in the paper, but you can see it play out just looking at your own YouTube homepage. Essentially, what it does is it optimizes for a set of recommendations as opposed to an individual recommendation, is a very simplistic way to say it. What ends up happening is, like, if you go to Facebook 2 years ago and you go to your newsfeed, right, the posts are going to be in more or less in order from the posts they think you're going to engage with the most down to the one they think you're going to engage with the least, right? And it's just going to go 1 to 100. What the DPP optimizer, as cited in the paper, does is it says, okay, maybe the best order is not 1 to 100. Maybe it's actually like 7, 3, 1, 5, 12 for a host of reasons. First and foremost, people's tendency to scroll, right? You also have to think that like the Facebook feed is a bit different in that it's like vertical and singular, whereas a YouTube, at the very least on desktop and TV, is more of a grid, right? On mobile, it is that linear. But regardless, the optimal experience for you might not be a 1 to 100 listing, right? It might have that randomness tied to it. It also has the effect of creating a sense in the viewer that there is a tremendous amount of content on the platform, and there are many different things that could satisfy their interest. And so kind of the first thing that, you know, YouTube's recommendation system has to figure out when you land on YouTube is like, why are you here? It's just like, welcome to YouTube. Why are you here? Like, and the way they do that is by giving you a lot of different potential content. Now, they learn over time, but it's constantly learning. So it's always testing out new things, right? And it's always trying to refine and refine and refine. Part of that is wanting viewers to think that there is a huge amount of content on YouTube, because there is. You can't wrap your mind around it. It's unbelievable. We throw out billions and trillions, like it's not numbers that are unfathomable to us as like humans. So when you talk about a viewer's experience and YouTube wanting them to feel like there's a lot, is because there is. And they don't want users to think like, oh, I go to YouTube and I get the same 5 channels recommended me. I'm bored. I don't want to see any more Mr. Beast, which no one's ever said. I've given him a hard time, but I think Jimmy's will be okay. But that can happen, right? Especially if like you're dealing with a creator that uploads once a week, right? Like if you come to YouTube multiple times a week, you've already been served that video. You've probably been served videos from their library, maybe that you've already watched before. And so like there has to be a good selection of content there to enforce that so that you come back regularly and feel like, oh, there's more things to discover in this interest I had, or I didn't even know I had this interest until I watched this content. Now I do have that interest, because YouTube's interested in satisfying viewers, right? And getting them to come back all the time.
Right.
They want you to come back every day and spend a lot of time there. And so the DPP optimizer does that, or at least whatever that has become does that. And part of the impact that has is making sure that there is a window between two similar of content. Now, what is really similar content? Content uploaded to the same channel, right?
Yep.
So in the paper, they say that the optimal distance between two similar of uploads is about 12, right? 12 different impressions. And so like if you go to YouTube on mobile and you're scrolling, you're not going to see an upload from the same user within that 12, like maybe here and there, right? If you're checking it out, but broadly speaking, you're not. And what ends up happening is they give preferential treatment to new videos for a host of reasons. First and foremost, in the very first paper that I read from YouTube that they released on the recommendation system, they said, we regularly observe that viewers prefer fresh content. You know, when you see that little new tag next to a video, that's to indicate to the viewer, hey, there's something new here for you, right? Because YouTube doesn't want to be just a repository. They also want to be where the conversation is happening, right? And you, as generally speaking, we as humans want to be where the action is and what's happening, right? Blah, blah, blah. And so that new content gets preferential treatment because viewers prefer it, but also because YouTube doesn't have any data on it, right? They don't know who this video might be great for. And so if you've uploaded a video within 24 hours, that video, the first video you uploaded, right, is going to get less impressions from people landing on the YouTube homepage, on people in the middle of their sessions, because YouTube now has a new video from you to serve to people that might be interested in your content based on their past watch history of watching your content, because that's who they go to first. Who is most likely to like and enjoy and be satisfied by your latest video? People who were satisfied by all your previous stuff. Right. And if you satisfy them, right, and a good portion of them, well, then they're going to serve it to people who are only sometimes satisfied, right? And if you really satisfy those people, well, then they're going to serve it to people who have maybe never been satisfied by your video. And that's how you expand and grow an audience. But you first have to serve that core audience, the people who've been satisfied in the past, in order to reach more and additional audiences.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes perfect sense. Now, somewhere in that conversation, you talked about how frequent one might upload. Now, when I was watching your video, you said something that kind of blew my mind, but it makes a lot of sense. When new creators ask me how often should they upload, I always answer with, there's no right or wrong answer. Your upload frequency depends on your lifestyle and how you can fit it in. What I will say is that whatever you decide, make sure it's something that you can do on a consistent basis. So if you can upload once a week, make sure you can upload once every single week. If you want to upload twice a week, make sure you can upload two videos every single week, this, that, and the other. Whatever you decide, it's not right, it's not wrong. Just make sure you can do it on a consistent basis. Watching your video yesterday, I saw you say that either upload 3 times a week or 7 times a week. Matt, what? 7 times? Who is uploading 7 times a week, Matt? How does that work?
Gamers and T-Series. I think they're uploading like 15 times a day.
Ooh. Wow.
They don't count, right?
They don't count.
So this goes back to me talking to media companies, right? And like, I have a tendency, I will admit it, to like take the human element out of things.
just a little bit.
That is what all of you just said is fantastic advice for the human, right? I'm concerned about the property. Mm-hmm. So if we think about a YouTube channel as a small business or a media property, then that's great advice, right? If we think about it as like, a human being has to do this thing, it's not your advice is much better for everybody. And so like that said, like the 3 or 7, right? Because it ties into the previous question as well. The reason 3 is so that you have 48 hours between uploads, right? Because once kind of 36 to 48 hours, generally speaking, like you kind of moved out of the window of getting featured placement because a video is new. A video has gotten most of the impressions it's going to get from the homepage in terms of like YouTube's quote unquote, like testing period of a new video, right? And so like, if you put out a new video after 48 hours after the last one, the previous one's kind of gotten its browse and homepage impressions, and you're not going to really step on it with the new one. And so when we talk about like 3, that's really a big part of the thinking. Right? Because each new upload, you want to get the max audience possible as quickly as possible because of the potential for exponential growth on a video based on, you know, collaborative filtering. And the more you can get earlier, the faster it's going to go and expand and da 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 da. When we get to 4, 5, and 6, you're going to be stepping on a previous upload. They're going to get knocked out. They're not going to get as much reach as they potentially could, which means that they might have a harder time. And what we're doing, we're basing this on is probability, right? There's always going to be exceptions, right? I'm not really interested in the exceptions to the rules, right? Like, great, fantastic. You found a quirk, wonderful. You know, it's irrelevant. So when you get to 7, though, you've got an upload every day. And now you're just playing, let's put as many chips on the board as we possibly can, right? Let's put as many pieces of content as we can. Like, we know we're not playing a optimization game in the sense of each upload is going to be like lovingly crafted, thoroughly thought through, and you're working on all the packaging, and like each piece has to carry more weight, because when you have so many more bets down on the board, one of them's going to take off, right? Like, if I upload daily, by the end of the year, I've got 365 uploads. If you upload weekly, right, you've got 50 uploads, right? I have 7x, 700% more chances to generate viewership out on YouTube than another channel. And the vast majority of them are going to do well, but I only need like 5 to hit, right?
Right. And
the percentage of that is like, I don't know, 1 out of 70, right? So it's like 3, 4%, right? If you need 5 to hit, you need 10% to hit and do very, very well, right? If like we're doing a comparison here, that's a much bigger average, like batting average. That's a huge difference. It's that perspective on like 3 versus 7. You can grow massive audiences with one upload a week. That said, if you're doing great with one upload a week, if you can get to 2, keep up the quality, keep up the audience's interest, it's not just going to be double the views, right? It might be 3 or 4x the views, because those videos are going to end up getting more views. You're going to have more chances to bring in more new audiences that are going to fall in love with the overall value proposition and watch each next consecutive video.
Definitely. Awesome, man. Awesome breakdown. I want to ask you, since you are very knowledgeable about the YouTube algorithm, or as you would say, algorithms, what is the biggest mistake that you see creators make as they think about the YouTube algorithm, or in the way that they think about the YouTube algorithm?
Well, I'm gonna quote Creator Insider here and Todd, and I'm drawing a blank on her name, but she has been doing a number of videos recently that are really strong. And like, it's first and foremost, like, think about it as the recommendation system as a whole has a ton of different variables. And really what it's designed to do is to find videos for a viewer. Their number one priority is the audience. And it makes so much sense when you think about it. And secondly, from a standpoint of understanding, appreciate what you can control. Invest in that. What you can control, and the most important element, is the overall value proposition. And spend time thinking about that and be honest with yourself about it. Third, packaging. If someone does not click on your video, they cannot be satisfied with it, cannot go on to watch more of your videos, YouTube takes that into account and it'll be less likely to serve them videos in the future. Thumbnail and title is more important than the video itself.
Can you repeat that for the people in the back? This man just said title and thumbnail are more important than the video itself. Woo!
It's true.
Man.
So like, spend the time on it, look at it, look at your thumbnail on the YouTube home screen. Like, there's a couple different tools out there that do that. Just take a screenshot and, you know, hover your thumb over top of it. Look at it in search. How does it look in comparison to the rest? Does it stand out? Look at it in dark mode. Spend time thinking about it, right? And then from like a titling perspective, like, don't think about SEO. And I'm just repeating what you and many, many other people have said. Don't even worry about SEO, because if you've programmed your channel correctly, it's going to happen regardless, right? And SEO shouldn't even be a concept that enters your head at this point. It should really be DEO, Discovery Engine Optimization, because that's where viewership is coming from. And to get discovered, you need a high click-through rate, relatively speaking, and you need great engagement in the video. That's average view duration, right? Average percentage viewed, I think, has some impact, but not really. It's average view duration. So if you're taking care of that, everything else will take care of itself, because there's 2 billion logged in users on YouTube.
Right.
They watch like 50, 60 videos a day on average. It's trillions of views on the platform. And if you get, let's say you get 10 million monthly views, which for most people would be a ton, right? That puts you in the top 0.001% of creators easily, right? 10 million monthly views. You're talking about like 0.0001, maybe 0.00001% of the viewership on YouTube in a given month. You double that and you're at 20 million, right? Most people are losing their minds at 20 million. It's nothing. It is not even close to even on the scale of like YouTube viewership. It is so tiny, but to the individual, it is huge. And it is huge. It is a huge accomplishment. That is not what I'm saying.
Right.
What I'm saying is like the scale is there. Like you just don't have to like worry about, oh, am I reaching a max in terms of viewership and my niche and blah, 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 blah. It's thumbnails, it's titles, it's average view duration. Get out of your head. Focus on that.
Mm. Woo! That is absolute fire by my man, Matt. So, Matt, if creators want to work with you and Little Monster Media, do you have like criteria for how that works or how should they start that process?
Just reach out. Reach out on our website. Someone will get back to you very quickly.
Cool. Now, do you guys have like certain criteria for creators that you work with or is it a case-by-case basis? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, like generally speaking, like there's no like size restrictions or anything like that. Like we're generally not going to work with people who are interested in finding some exploit or like do conspiracy theories or stuff like that. Like we don't have the time. We also don't believe in it. It wouldn't, you know, fall within our principles of like wanting to do good in the world. Outside of that, like we'll work with anyone. Generally speaking though, like we find the best results when you're doing at least, you know, 1 to 5 million monthly views, kind of depending on like niche and vertical and ability to put out content. But we don't have any thresholds, right? If you want to work with us and, you know, principles are aligned, then we'd love to work with you.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Any parting words for the creators out there, Matt, the inspiring creator before we get out of here?
Don't overthink it, right? Like if this is a hobby, if this is part-time, if you're just like looking to grow, make content, learn, right? Like Roberto says it all the time and cites it all the time. You know, PewDiePie made what, like 200 some odd videos before he had 2000 subscribers. Mr. Beast made 100 before he was like at 1000 or something. Like the best way to learn is just to get out there and do, right? And, you know, learn from your mistakes. I'm definitely of the generation or at least of the type where it's like, you know, instructions come on like how to set something up. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. I'm going to spend 10 minutes reading this when I could spend an hour and a half trying to figure it out on my own. Please, I'll take the hour and a half every day of the week. I have to learn from experience. So like get out there and do, right? And, you know, learn that way. Read everything you can, watch everything you can, and obviously listen to Tube Talk.
Absolutely, man. Matt Gielen, it has been an absolute pleasure, my dude. Thank you for making the time today. Definitely appreciate you.
Thanks for having me on, man. It was a pleasure meeting you as well.
Absolutely. And for all of y'all listening out there, thank you for listening to another episode of Tube Talk. For Matt, I am Viper. We will see you next week on another episode of Tube Talk presented by VidIQ.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tube Talk brought to you by VidIQ. Head over to vidIQ.com/tubetalk for today's show notes and previous episodes. Enjoy the rest of your video making day.